Hi, I'm Leah.
And I'm Bree.
And this is the Bad Taste Book Club, where we talk about books that don't sometimes fit into your normal genres. Today we're talking about Tamsin Muir and her book Gideon the Ninth.
Yeah!
Gideon the Ninth is an interesting one. I really enjoyed it, but I listened to the audiobook before I read the book, so I think that...
I think audiobooks at the end of the day are a really different experience sometimes. Like, a well-read audiobook can completely change your opinion on a book.
Yeah, for sure.
It's a completely different reading experience.
I definitely have enjoyed some audiobooks more than I've enjoyed reading the book, and I've gone the other way as well.
Whereas I read the book the old-fashioned way. And yeah, I had interesting thoughts on this one, so this is going to be a fun episode to talk about.
Well, we'll go into the premise because it's an odd one. So it takes place in a post-apocalyptic world. Like, it kind of takes place after something awful has happened, and a long time in the future, say 900 years or so after something
awful
happened.
Well, it could not even be our future, necessarily. It's on some planets in space.
Yes. And we
something has happened.
There are 9 houses, so that kind of made me think, planetary, that's the way that it worked. But
that's how I understood it, but I could have been wrong.
Yes, and yeah. I'm like, well, we had 9 planets. So yeah, but it does take place after a great cataclysm happened, and the Emperor saved everybody in a non-specified way.
Yeah, this is one of those books where the author has definitely thought a lot about the world building. So if you like worlds that have like lots of very unique world building, great for you. If you're like me and you can't stand that, not so good.
This is one of the places where Brie and I are quite differ, because I'm a sucker for a good world build. And Brie does not give a shit.
I'm kind of like, if it's a good world build and I don't have to spend a majority of the novel trying to get my head around the world to enjoy the characters and the plot, I'm fine. But like, sometimes I feel like being too precious about how great your world building is can distract from the actual reader's enjoyment and getting into the plot and the characters. And I'm a character girl. I'm always here for the characters.
Yeah. And look, I definitely agree with you. I just think in this case, I thought it drew that line, and I think for you it went over.
Yeah.
Our main characters are aristocrats, I guess, is how you term it.
Yeah, it's kind of like there's definitely, how would you define the genre of this book? Because to me, there's aspects of this which is like a fantasy court drama, for sure. And then there's definitely some sci-fi elements. And then we also have some horror aspects. Adventure story.
I'm gonna call it speculative fiction because that's the cop-out that I love. Broadly, I guess it's sci-fi in that, so what happens is that our main character aristocrats are all necromancers, so you would say that is a fantasy conceit, but I think in this case it's sci-fi because they do try and ground it in science.
I don't know, it still feels pretty explicitly magical to me.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a bit hand-wavy either way.
See, I wouldn't necessarily call this speculative fiction, because to me, spec fic is always taking, like, pre-existing things and extrapolating from a point.
Sci-fantasy.
Yeah, it's interesting, because sometimes I wondered what the point of having it set in space even was, because I didn't know how much it really lent to the setting.
I definitely think, because this is a trilogy, this first book, it doesn't make much of a difference, except for it kind of lends to the second 2/3 of the book being a bottle episode. Like, nobody can get off the island, essentially, or planet in this case.
Yeah, that's true, actually. I didn't quite think of that, but I feel like you could construct reasons to create that in other settings.
Oh, for sure. But I do think there are ways that you could have done this where that wasn't the case, but I think space is cool.
Look, I'm not going to doubt it. Space is very, very cool. It is definitely cool.
And I have a feeling that this does take place on, like, and this is just my own personal, like, in our solar system, and so it's going to become more, like, integral to the plot later on. So our main character is Gideon the Ninth, who is a orphan foundling on is in the Ninth House, who is the Death House, which makes kind of no sense because everybody is a Death House in there.
They're not necessarily, they're not just the Death House, they're the Bone House.
Right, yeah.
That's the thing.
Like, they're House of the Locked Tomb, which never really comes up in this book, and it's kind of like,
it comes up a few times, but it has no relevance to the plot.
Yeah, it's not plot relevant, but it means that they're like the weirdos of this very weird world.
They are like the most goth of the goth houses, because they're all a little bit goth in one way or another. They could potentially categorize them all as a different type of goth.
Oh yeah, these guys are classical.
I mean, they've got, part of their ritual is they have, like, skeleton face paint, which is just fascinating. And they sort of describe them as, like, nuns, which just makes me think of, like, Ghost or something. One of those metal bands that just has very, like, skeleton face and, like, almost religious-looking clothes, which is just a real fun image.
Yeah, I have to say, like, their planet sounds terrible and I'd never want to visit, but it's well-constructed and really interesting to think about. Bone servants doing all your work for you all the time, and, like, how depressing it would be to never see the sun, and, so, which is why I think it's Pluto.
I'm intrigued that you think it's so grounded in our solar system, because I just assumed it was a solar system.
Random.
Like, I took definitely that the ninth house and the ninth planet was the furthest planet from the sun. Like, that's very explicit. But, like, the first house sounds nothing like the first planet in our solar system.
True, that's true, but also, I'm like, it takes place way in the future. Who knows what happens in the future? So,
yes. Yeah, I see, I didn't even take it as it happens way in the future, because as much as there's definitely tech and sci-fi, it's not, like, a hyper-tech world. It's actually really grounded, and I guess that's that post-apocalyptic element that you were talking about. Like, there's technology, but, you know, they are using swords.
That's true. I guess the thing is, like, the fact that it is post-apocalyptic is kind of a blink and you'll miss it
reference.
They do mention it a couple of times. So you've got nine houses. Gideon's from the last one. I don't even know what to call Harrowhawk. Harrowhawk Nona Jesimus, or Harrow as she's called, or is there something else that she calls her? She calls her, like, three things. This is Bree's, like, least favourite part of this entire thing.
This is going to be really hard, because every single character has at least two names, plus a title, plus usually a nickname or innuendo, and they're always used interchangeably, all the time, with no explanation. In fact, the whole book starts with a list of all your characters like you would get in a play and a short synopsis. See, I am the sort of person who sees that and immediately goes, I am not doing homework before I start your book. And so I actually opted not to read it because I was really curious if the
bad decision.
Look, I vaguely knew what was going on. But just because, like, I was like, okay, I need to get into this, and, like, I tried to read it multiple times and I just couldn't get started because, like, reading about the characters without any context is, like, the least interesting thing for me to do. So I really struggled with that choice from my perspective. I'm the sort of person who likes to put that stuff at the back.
I'm always excited by a dramatis personae. Like, it makes me happy.
I'm glad it made you happy.
It made one of us happy, at least.
Made me angry, it made you happy.
And this is why we do a podcast. podcast together because it would be really boring if we always agreed.
We've got, like, the ninth house, and every house at their core has a necromancer and a cavalier, which is kind of like your space magician and their knight.
Yes. Nona Jesmith is,
Let's call her Harrow.
Yes. Nona Jesmith, Harrow Hawk, Harrow, that bitch that I work for occasionally.
What's the other one they call her? Reverend Sister of the Ninth House?
Yes.
Like, so many names, folks.
So, she killed her parents when she was 12, and that sounds like a spoiler, but it literally comes out in the first two pages. And mummified them to the point where nobody knows they're dead.
So she's effectively, like, we're introduced to the stakes is Gideon desperately wants to leave the knife and go join the military because everyone here fucking hates her and she hates fucking everyone.
Except for her sword teacher.
Except for her sword teacher, of course.
Sword master, I guess.
Sword master. And Harrow is effectively the monarch, although she's pretending that she's not in charge because she's pretending her parents aren't dead.
They're just mute. Because they took a vow of silence.
Those handy vows of silence. It's a big thing in the Ninth House, and I'm starting to think that's just for convenience sake.
Yes. Because the book is from the perspective of Gideon. You think that Harrow is a terrible person at the beginning, and I think at least some of that is just Gideon's colouring of who Harrow is. Because I think Harrow is just a desperately lonely person who is clinging to the only person who's vaguely in the same, like, age range. And
she is also a ginormous bitch.
Oh, she is.
Like, she did the bullying thing as kids for many years.
I just think that she, like, I think by the end of the book, at least, I had some sympathy for her actions, perhaps.
Oh, I loved her immediately, even though she was a giant.
Okay. I forgot how you feel about bitches.
To me, the strongest part of this whole book is Harrow and Gideon as characters.
I love them.
Because Harrow is very, like, she's very posturing, she's putting on a face all the time, appearances are very important to her because that's the structure she's raised in, whereas Gideon is constantly...
Not that.
Yeah, just wants to flip it off and run for it. And, so, like, as an odd couple, they're really interesting. I'm, like... For me personally, what the flip side of that is, I didn't think there was enough of them together.
No, I definitely could have seen more of that. They're really funny together.
Like, they were just so much fun together. So that's sort of the dynamic we've got going on. And effectively what's happened is all the houses have been called to, I think it's the first planet from memory.
Yes.
By the Emperor to, and so they're all getting ready and you have to go as your necromancer and your cavalier, who's like your bodyguard and your knight, except the cavalier from the Ninth House
fucks.
Yeah, and he's sort of now just, he goes AWOL effectively. His mum takes him off planet.
His mummy saves him.
Yes. So that leaves Harrow with needing Gideon.
And Gideon had just tried to escape the planet to become a
soldier,
which is how the Cavalier got away. So now, given that it is her fault that the Cavalier got away, she has to be the Cavalier. Oh no, that definitely wasn't Harrow's idea from the beginning.
This, yeah, even though it's from Gideon's perspective, it's very obvious that Harrow wanted Gideon as her cavalier from the get-go.
Which, who wouldn't? She is a badass with a two-handed sword. Do you know how heavy those are to lift? They're really fucking heavy.
So sweet, sweet biceps. Yes, that is a point in a scene. The sweet, sweet biceps that Gideon has. It is the most endearing moment in this whole novel.
You didn't like the bit where she promised the guy porn for letting her go? I did
also quite enjoy the trying to barter her way off planet with porn.
Necromancer porn. Very weird.
Look, I'd be into it. That's also, like, our very explicit, like, let me hit you with a sledgehammer, Gideon is gay moment, because it's all the porn involves lots of tits.
Yeah. It's very cheesecakey.
So that's sort of what we've got going into the ninth house, and then we're pretty quickly introduced to the other nine houses. Do we want to, like, do a quick, being the operative word, sort of rundown of what dynamics or archetypes we've got for each house?
Okay, let's...
So the first house of the host.
So the first house is the emperor. The second house, does that even come up? There are a couple of characters who are kind of just...
Oh, yeah, there. Yeah. They're the second house of the military house.
Yeah, so they're kind of... there are a couple of houses that, while they're...
There are too many houses in this book.
There are nine houses. So there are eight houses on the thing. There's kind of the big other one is the third house, who are the mouth of the emperor, which is Corona Beth, Tridentarius. And you will not get me saying that again. And
we'll call
then,
her Beth.
Yeah, we can call her Beth.
That was the third house, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so we have Corona Beth and Ianthe, who are two sisters, and both of them are necromancers, and they're extremely good swordsman cavalier.
Yes.
There's a weird conflict going on between the three of them that's just simmering all the time from the moment we get introduced to them.
And then you've got the fourth house.
Yeah.
So they're the team. So that's Isaac and Jean-Marie. And they're great in the audiobook.
I was actually really confused who they were for a while. The way their text is written in the book is it's usually a small font, like they're sort of whispering, and they're very closely associated with the fifth house.
Yeah.
And I kind of assumed they were the fifth house's kids, but that wouldn't make any sense. But that's the dynamic we have.
Yeah, I think they're like nieces and nephews to the fifth house. They're kind of like whiny teens, and it's beautiful. It's just very funny.
That definitely came across. They just it just made them feel like lesser characters, because when you literally minimize their dialogue, as much as I think the goal was to make it sound like the whine of a teenager,
yeah,
it makes me feel like the dialogue is less important, so my eyes almost automatically skim
it. Yeah.
I did find as they became more central to the story later on, I really liked them as characters, and the bicep scene we were talking about directly involves the two teens being deeply impressed by Gideon's biceps, which is just amazing.
Perfect. It's wonderful.
It was just very good.
She wrote them perfectly, but they're not stereotypically, like they're not awful, even though Gideon calls them awful.
They're teenagers not written by someone who hates teenagers.
Yes, which is nice.
The fifth house are a husband and wife couple. So the wife is the necromancer and the husband is the cavalier. And he is just this charming man. He's super friendly, loves people,
yeah,
very jovial. I loved him as a character.
I almost like visualize him as kind of like a Brian Blessed type, like really big, big beard, happy, deep booming voice to see you.
Yeah. Have you watched Penny Dreadful? You know the professor in that? That's immediately how I envisioned him.
Oh, yes. I can see that.
Yeah. Like he was just very much that archetype. Our sixth house are the ones that seem to be the most direct rival, at least in terms of necromancers, between Harrow and the sixth house necromancer.
Yes. So you've got Palamedes, who's a excellent necromancer, and Camilla, who is a hardcore warrior.
The sixth house were very much the medical science house to me. Out of all the houses, they were the ones who talked the most about necromancy as a science.
And then you have the seventh house, who is the love triangle portion of this.
They are absolutely the runner-up for the second most goth house. They're the house that is directly responsible for romanticising consumption during the Victorian period.
Yes.
That is them.
So we've got Dulcina Septimus. I'm really glad that I listened to the audiobook, because I actually am pretty confident on all these names. And her very not that great cavalier. This one is difficult. And her cavalier, let's just say. And he's kind of like this angry, quiet dude.
He immediately gave me Frankenstein vibes the moment he showed
interesting.
Up.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So that was definitely, he is definitely that big, burly, very silent, loyal, like not much of a personality assistant with a sword kind of thing.
Yes. Dulcinea is dying of blood cancer, I believe they say. Because she's a necromancer, that's actually kind of a good thing. Because the way that they explain necromancy is that it's about gaining energy from decay.
Mm.
It's kind of like mushrooms.
Mushrooms! Yes.
So it means that dead things are good, and if you are dying constantly in your own body, then that gives you
limitless supply of death.
You're a dynamo for yourself, essentially.
There is also kind of the implication that, yeah, the sixth house is the medical house. The seventh house is the one that goes, oh, you're dying. Oh, it'll bring you closer to, like, magic.
Yeah, so I think they're the mad scientist house because of how they are breeding cancer into their family so they can be better at death magic.
They are absolutely the most gothic with a big capital G sort of house.
I would not be surprised
with a capital R
if they were wearing ruffled shirts and
I take that back.
Velvet.
They are the romantic with the big ass fucking capital R house
and crushed velvet in their day to day lives. Like,
I always assumed her lounging in a ruffled nightgown every time I saw that character.
Yeah, she does a lot of lounging because she's very very thick. There is the eighth house.
They're the righteous bigots. Don't like the ninth house.
That's right. They fucking hate the ninth house. So you've got the nine houses. You spend the first sort of half of the book setting up the premise of the worlds and the characters. And then second half of the book turns into a murder mystery.
Yeah, so this is kind of what I meant when I feel like there were too much genres. So it sets up and you're like, okay, yeah, cool. We're in space. Right. We're going to have like some sort of court drama with like political intrigue and trials and people trying to one-up one another, and then suddenly it's a murder mystery like Agatha Christie style in a confined mansion.
I guess the thing is, the premise of the world is that there's space royalty going to see the big royal and find out some things so that they can become better space royalty. And then in that means that they kind of have to do this escape room.
It's essentially a maze of escape rooms. So they're told, like, yo, there's this thing down here. It's like an abandoned science facility, right? And, like, you can't enter any doors that are locked, right? But if you get given a key, you're allowed to enter. So they have to do all these challenges to get keys to access rooms, which then give them more information to, like, pull things apart. I really enjoyed the challenges. The minute Gideon starts to be more involved with the challenges and her and Harrow have to work together is the minute where I was like, yes.
Definitely when they start working together, you kind of see more of that odd couple personality clash that makes this book so, like, good.
I just don't think you get enough time with it.
Fair enough. And this is where it kind of veers into sci-fi for me, anyway. The way in which the necromantic magic is constructed is very much, if you put X and Y together, you get Z, and you will always get Z, which is kind of different from how I see magic.
I've seen it described as a space opera, which I definitely think is the way to describe it. I'm the sort of person who likes it when you kind of smash science and magic together. So, it didn't bother me too much. It was just, I think it was more the genre jumping in terms of like the plot structure that drove me mad.
So we'll light spoil and then right at the very end we'll tell you when we're going to get to the big spoilers. So what happens is they go down in the old labs, do some magic stuff or science stuff depending on your interpretation of the text, and
magic science.
Yes. And then they come back, have a big to-do. The teens are mortified by Magnus because he tells stories of when they were children, which they don't like because they're teens.
Oh, yes, the fourth specifically are very upset about that. This is, again, why I assumed he was their father. And it's really interesting. This book has a interesting balance, particularly in the first half, of just, like, really modern, funny moments.
Yeah, I actually, I think that's the thing that I really liked about this particular author's work, is that it felt so fresh.
See, I felt like the initial setup to me and the ending... Right. Felt very deliberative to me, but we won't get to the ending yet.
So they do some magic science, and then
there's a murder.
I was gonna say there's a cavalier fight, like
a cavalier duel,
a couple of those, where they find out that Gideon is sick at sword fighting and is very, very good at it.
And Gideon is, like, presenting as this very gruff, terrifying, like, Harrow has told everyone that Gideon has a vowel of silence, so...
Yes, that comes up again.
to not talk. And has pretty much told Gideon, just like, I'm off doing my thing, just don't fucking talk to anyone. If I hear that you talk to someone, I'm going to kill you in a creative manner. And so Gideon is this silent with, like, skeleton face paint, shock of red hair in a big, like, cloak with, like, sunnies on because why not? And also a terrifying badass of a sword fighter.
Because she has sunglasses, because she's never seen the sun this close before. She can't deal with it. I can only imagine, A, how cool the goth, like, horror twin thing that she is. Like, imagine as a goth teenager seeing someone like Gideon the Ninth and being just like, yes. That is who I want to be when I grow up.
Yeah, Gideon is... And it's very funny because she's presenting such a scary, stoic figure, but the inner monologue we get from Gideon is just kind of like someone who just really wants to fight and have a good time and get off this rock and have fun and really wants to stab things.
She's kind of like a himbo.
I love Gideon so much. She's kind of... Yeah, she's very fun. There was a particular moment where they're doing a test and it's just effectively, there's this big monster, it's got lots of pointy things, and Gideon goes, the arms kind of look like swords, I want to fight it. That was Gideon's whole MO. And that was the point where I was like, I could get behind this if the book was just more of this.
Yes, these guys as an odd couple are just really good.
Yeah, they're really good. So, yeah, we have a lot of quests, then one of the house's pairs get killed. So from here, we're definitely spoilers.
I kind of liked the idea of a murder mystery.
I did too.
It was an interesting... I didn't think that's where the book was going to go, and so when it got there, I was like, oh, interesting. I think they did enough work in the first half making you care about some of the characters that died to make the death seem tragic.
I sincerely agree. I'm glad we agree on some things about this book. That was the first bit where I was like, okay, I like where this is going. The murder mystery is really interesting. We stick with this murder mystery setting for a while. You get more of the court intrigue when people start accusing one another.
Yes.
And that sort of Agatha Christie, everyone's got motives and knows little bits and pieces of information about people. And everyone has a secret.
Yes.
So that's a really fun twist. And we have more people get killed off.
And I think it's actually quite interesting because the second house tries to take over.
Yeah, so the second house is the military house and the highest ranked within the military. So their attitude is, we're the cops, come on, let us deal with it.
So there's a big fight. The second house essentially loses because everybody is like, no, fuck you, we don't want to pay attention to you. And then more murders. The next murder is the hardest for me. I love the teens, and it's really sad when they die.
The twins was really hard. Particularly, and this is when it starts to pivot into like a murder mystery slash horror.
Yes, because there's blood writing on the wall.
You know, one of the teens gets killed in a locked room with Gideon. And this is something that I think the beginning sets up enough to allow it to happen when it pivots from, like, murder into horror. Because you've got, like, this reoccurring thing that there's something down in the facility. When we talk about genre hopping and when I'm saying the genre hopping didn't work for me, this is the bit that did, and this is the bit I like.
I think, again, because they set up the terrible teens to be such sympathetic and interesting characters, that when Jean-Marie dies...
Yeah.
It's really heart-wrenching, actually. Yeah. Gideon's feeling all sorts of things about it because she's the Cavalier. She actually had, like, warm feelings towards them and wanted to save them but couldn't.
And then she has the survivor's guilt of being in the room.
Yes, while this other person, like...
is slaughtered in their sleep.
Yes, and it's, it's really sad. And I think it did it really well. Like,
absolutely.
Like, we've been talking about genre and stuff. I think the strength of this book is that even though it is fantastical, the emotions are quite real.
It did a good job of knowing which characters it had to get you to care about early on in the book, and I think it achieved that really well.
We have a bunch more deaths.
We're going to talk about the last third of the book, which means we're just going to be really frank, because if we try and dodge spoilers talking about what works and what doesn't, it's just going to be annoying work in this to book. Listen to.
Like, some books we can be vague about it, but this particular book, the big reveals are such that they are giant reveals. Shall we talk about the murderer? Did you see that coming?
I sort of did.
Really? Because I wasn't like, there's no way that could be the case. I think they did a good job of setting up that could be the case. But I was shocked.
I was fairly sure it was going to turn out to be that house.
Yes.
From pretty early on. I didn't see the other twist to it, which was that the seventh house, they weren't who they said they were.
So the seventh house turns out to be the murderess. Dulcinea has not been alive this entire time, and neither has her cavalier.
I saw that coming a mile off.
Yeah, I didn't. I was like, when you were saying before that it was a Frankenstein, I was like, oh, somebody picked up on that real early.
Yeah, I saw that happening. Like, it was very quick that I realised. But the second reveal, Dulcinea, I didn't realise she was what the first house's Lictor.
So Lictor is what they're all trying to become. I really liked this twist. What did you think of it?
It turning out to be the seventh house, fine. It being the Lictor, I didn't care enough about the Lictors. I could also even see you keeping that but making it less of a, oh, look at this big reveal, and making it something more subtle.
Yes.
Not necessarily doing the villain speech about, oh, I'm the first Lictor and I'm here to kill the Emperor. This is all my motions in one go. So my curiosity is, what did you think of, like, what the Lictors were as a premise? Because I liked aspects of it, but I didn't like the full way it was executed personally.
Right. So, again, huge spoiler. What happens to become a Lictor? Your cavalier, they have to die and you have to absorb their soul into yourself.
And then you get all their skills and their power.
Yes. This happens to Gideon, which makes me sad.
I hated it so much.
Having said that, I think that the character arc of Gideon going from a very selfish, self-centered person at the very beginning of the book who just wants to get away and doesn't want to have any responsibilities to effectively martyring herself at the end of the book in order to save people is a really nice through line for her.
Interesting. See, I didn't think it earned that character arc.
Okay.
I just didn't think that was clear enough. I think it's also just personal preference. Yeah. And, like, that narrative is not my preferred, like, approach.
Yes. I'm never, like, super into Kill Your Gaze, but I think that depending on where this next book goes, it can be forgiven here. Yeah. I really, really enjoyed this book. And I think having talked about it, there's a lot you did like.
There's definitely bits I did like, but between the ending making me so mad and the beginning just being so slow and, like, the stuff that I liked not being there enough, I found I was really cranky. I got to the end, I was reading the end last night, and I'm just like, okay, cool. Where is the Gideon Harrow finally learning how to work together? Like, I don't feel like we got that moment.
I want them to smooch.
I just don't think we got that promised moment of Gideon Harrow learning how to work together without Gideon having to just be absorbed into Harrow's subconscious. Like,
well, I mean, look, if you're going to work together, being in the same brain maybe helps. In terms of this book, how would you score it out of skeletons?
Are we doing a 5 or a 10?
5 goth skeletons.
Maybe a 2?
Oh, really? This is a solid 4 goth skeletons for me.
If you like high fantasy and like sci-fi sort of smushed together, you will like this book.
Yes.
If and you're lukewarm on either of those, maybe not.
Magic of editing means that I always sound like I'm correct even when I'm wrong.